The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
A new UN report says the sky is falling. I've been hearing this for 50 years, so you know what? Call me when it does fall. Obama has a regular super spreader event, his 60th birthday bash. I'll talk about that. And the Texas Democrats file a lawsuit against Governor Abbott that I have to call the lawsuit from Mars. This is the Dinesh D'Souza podcast.
America needs this voice. The times are crazy. In a time of confusion, division, and lies, we need a brave voice of reason, understanding, and truth. This is the Dinesh D'Souza Podcast.
The United Nations has a new report. This is put out by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC. Now, by the way, this is a body that has been discredited for putting out bogus data, bogus reports that have been called into question because of all kinds of shenanigans. So this latest report is nothing more than a new effort to whoop up climate fear. Why? Because as with COVID, fear is a great political motivator. Fear makes you do things you wouldn't otherwise do. Now, let's look in a sober way at what this report is saying. It's got hundreds of pages of documentation, most of it generated from so-called climate models. So the idea of a climate model is that you put in data, and of course, it all depends on what data you put in, and then you extrapolate the data over generally a longer period of time. So, for example, you can put in data from, let's say, 1970 to the present. That would be data carefully calculated to show warming because there was substantial warming between the 70s and the 90s, although not so much since then, but you can show warming over a 50-year period. Of course, if you went 50 years back, you would then find the data pointing in some cases in the opposite direction toward global cooling. And so the climate activists don't put that data in. They choose their date carefully to generate the result that they want, to maximize the extrapolation, so to speak. It's kind of like saying that, you know, your kid grew 3 inches in the past year and therefore extrapolating that out when he turns 70, he's going to be like 35 feet tall. A lot of times a model is garbage in, garbage out. That's a term actually from science called GIGO, garbage in, garbage out. It means that the result you get at the end of an extrapolation is totally influenced by what you put into the sausage machine in the first place. Now, according to these UN scientists, they say that the Earth's temperature has gone up by 1.5 degrees. They say that that this is the fastest rise in the past 50 years than they've seen before. Now, what's funny is the way that this report, 1.5 degrees, and by the way, if you went further back, let's say to a century, you'd find pretty much the same. The Earth is warm 1.5 degrees because prior to that, there was some warming, then there was some cooling. Warming and cooling appears to occur somewhat cyclically. It came up in my conversation with Dr. Neil Frank, I guess last week or the week before it was, where we talked about how in the 1970s, the big rage among the same climate activist community was over global cooling. So is the Earth warming? Is it cooling? The truth of it is it depends on where you look. It depends on which decades you choose. Now, you can't say this is obviously due to carbon dioxide because the levels of carbon dioxide that human beings have been putting into the atmosphere have consistently been going up since the Industrial Revolution, for about 150 years. So the trends toward warming and cooling can't be tracked to that alone. There's got to be other factors involved. Now, I love the way that CNN reports on this UN climate stuff. A quote, as the world battles historic droughts, landscape-altering wildfires, there's no wildfire that doesn't alter the landscape, and deadly floods, a landmark report from global scientists says the window is rapidly closing. The window is rapidly closing. I love these phrases. I mean, since I came to the United States in the 1970s, the window has been closing. It's been closing on food, it's been closing on population, it's been closing on the ozone layer, it's been closing on one thing or another. And here's Michael Mann, one of the biggest sort of climate scamsters there is around. He's the lead author of the IPCC's 2001 report. He goes, bottom line is we have 0 years left to avoid dangerous climate change. So this is, you know, people aren't buying it. And so they have to keep whipping up the alarm. I continue with CNN. He said, CNN talks about the quote, breakneck pace at which the climate has really been warming. Really? You consider 1.5 degrees a breakneck pace? And then it says that by 2050, I'm not quoting CNN, global temperature will still peak above the 1.5 degree threshold. Before falling. Wait. So this is not a consistent warming. It's apparently a warming that's supposed to go till 2050, and then the Earth is going to start cooling again. So I guess the idea is that we are facing a panicky window over the next 20 years. We've got to give up our lifestyle, stop doing this, stop doing that, stop driving cars, stop using fossil fuels. This is all a huge racket. In some ways, it reminds me of a racket that certain kind of fundamentalist preachers have going, in which they're always predicting the end of the world. It's kind of like, listen, you know, you haven't really been tithing recently. Pretty much turn over all your finances to us and don't worry about it. The world is coming to an end really soon. So you're not going to need all that cash. And so, you know, this is a phenomenon, the end of the worldism, let's call it. I mean, it's been going on for centuries. When the calendar showed 999 AD, people were like, oh my God, we're approaching 1000 AD. The world is going to come to an end. Remember, there was some of this fever at the turn of the millennium, millennial fever. Oh, there's going to be a catastrophe around the corner. I remember reading the late great Planet Earth. Oh, the Earth's going to, you know, there's going to be global conflict. The Antichrist is going to. And so all of this. Now, the left laughs at this stuff. Oh, you crazy fundamentalists, you're these wacky predictions, all this end of the worldism, except climate change is the secular equivalent of that. It is equally a kind of racket aimed at getting us to do things that we wouldn't otherwise do. These people have an uninterrupted history of being wrong. Every single prediction pretty much that they've made has not come to pass. They can't even call it global warming because then they're stuck with cooling. And so the term climate change is intended to cover all their bases. I mean, the climate's always going to be changing in some way. The way for it not to change would be to remain exactly the same forever. It's not going to do that. So climate change is pretty much a waste. It is the most unscientific of theories because it makes no valid predictions. Its history of prophecy is essentially a dead letter. And we can safely disbelieve all this nonsense and continue about our normal business. Yeah, if the sky's falling, give us a call when it actually happens. Guys, so Mike Lindell's Cyber Symposium begins today. It goes on for a couple of days, I believe, through Thursday. And here's Mike talking about it. Listen.
I'm having a Cyber Symposium on August 10th, 11th, and 12th. This historical event will be live streamed 72 hours straight on my new platform, frankspeech.com.
Yeah, if you want to check this out, Mike says he's going to be offering also all kinds of MyPillow specials during the symposium on frankspeech.com. And all you got to do to get those discounts is you go into the website and enter promo code Dinesh. I want to talk about Mike's special on the Giza Dream Sheets. These are amazing. Debbie and I love them. The first night you sleep on these Giza sheets, you're never going to want to sleep on anything else. The Giza Dream Sheets come in a variety of colors and sizes. Mike is making a special offer for my listeners, sale of the year, for a limited time, 50% off, as low as $49.99 on the sheets. Call 1-800-876-0227 or go to mypillow.com. Make sure to use promo code D-I-N-E-S-H, Dinesh. The Texas Democrats have filed a lawsuit against Governor Abbott and some of the Republicans. And it is to compensate them for their enormous distress in what Abbott and the Republicans have made them do. You see, what's happened here, and let me kind of, I have here the lawsuit. It's in the usual sort of legalese. But what makes this really fun reading is there's a kind of an underlying narrative. We have to sort of read the text to get a feeling of what this narrative is, because it's downright comical. First of all, although there were 50-some Democrats who skipped town, apparently 22 of these Democrats have joined in the lawsuit. I think the others were too embarrassed. They're probably like, you want us to sign our names to this? But, you know, there are some bottom feeders in the Democratic Party. They're like, oh, yeah, we'll sign. So these 22 guys have signed. So they accuse Abbott of a, quote, scheme and conspiracy. To do what? To violate the state and federal constitutional rights of the plaintiffs, these Democrats, and the classes of citizens they represent. By denying rights under the 1st, 5th, and 14th Amendments to the Constitution. Sounds kind of serious. So now let's look to see what Abbott's great offense is. Number one, the Democrats say that once they got these planes together and skipped town, they have, quote, suffered much anxiety and distress over the separation from their families. Well, I mean, I don't doubt the distress. You know, their kids are like, Mom, what are you doing in D.C.? Or what are you doing in Colombia? What are you doing taking a vacation in Europe? What are you doing at the bar? You know, so, yeah. So apparently this is family distress that there's caused. But who caused it? The Democrats chose to skip town. They chartered the plane. They didn't want to present themselves at a legitimate legislative session. Now, this is where the plot thickens, actually, but which I mean gets funnier. The Texas Democrats claim Abbott has, quote, violated their constitutional rights on the basis of race. How? Quote, in that certain plaintiffs are either black or white. What? Yeah, so the plaintiffs, you see, are either black or white. I guess what they could have added in some are even brown. And by causing them all this distress, it's a racial affliction. Even though it would appear to be even-handedly dispensed over people of all different races. Now, let's continue. The Texas Democrats also claim that their constitutional rights have been violated on the basis of color, quote, and I find it hard to believe this was actually put in a legal document, but nevertheless, quote, in that certain plaintiffs are distinguishable based upon the melanin in their skin. So they're going into melanin theory here. Like, wow, the presence of melanin on the part of some of these Democrats suggests a potential racial motive. This is like critical race theory now finding its way into the law. Now, the Democrats also claim that Abbott has violated their rights on the basis of, quote, natural origin. Natural origin. Now, first of all, you can tell that the lawyer who wrote this is obviously a doofus because he doesn't know it's actually national origin. It's not natural origin. What I mean, you think it's a distinction whether you're born naturally or by cesarean? No, it's national origin. And it's clear that they meant that because they say, quote, because they say that, quote, certain plaintiffs are descendants of persons born in other countries. So they mean national origin, but obviously they didn't check this one for spelling. So what are we getting at here? The Texas Democrats also claim a class action lawsuit. So they're not just filing on their behalf, but on behalf of others, quote, similarly situated. Yeah? Who are the others? Who are the others who are in an exactly similar situation that could be joining the lawsuit? Obviously, the lawsuit doesn't say, for the obvious reason, that there aren't any. This was a decision undertaken voluntarily by the Texas Democrats, who obviously don't want to face the consequences of their own actions. Now, good news is the Republicans are sort of hanging tough here. They're going to call legislative session after session. Hey, if these guys want to spend the rest of the year and the better part of next year out of town, fantastic. Because the Republicans can then make the point to the electorate that this is the essence of democratic irresponsibility. In fact, this is an active subversion of the democratic process. And I think this will be very damaging for the Democrats come 2022. So they kind of know it. They went on a last-ditch mission to try to push this HR1 at the federal level. They're making little or no headway there. So they're now in a bind. So all of this is a kind of somewhat ridiculous, preposterous effort to save face and try to get probably probably some Democratic judge to give them some limited form of vindication. But I think reading through the lawsuit and exercising straight stand-up comedy, I mean, you could stand up and deliver this lawsuit at any improv and get a pretty good response. You are dealing with some very crooked, stupid people who are now facing, ultimately, the consequences of their own behavior. Refinancing your mortgage can make a big difference in your life, especially with today's low rates. You could save up to $1,000 a month. That's money you can use to pay off debt, invest, improve your home. It's totally up to you. As long as you call American Financing, America's home for home loans. They're a national mortgage lender with expert mortgage consultants, meaning they provide a no pressure, no obligation experience. You never pay upfront or hidden fees because they truly follow a consultative approach, working with you to find the greatest overall savings. My stepson Justin is looking into this. He's buying his first house. And what are you waiting for? It just takes 10 minutes to start. You can pre-qualify for free by calling 888-528-1219. That number again, 888-528-1219, or visit AmericanFinancing.net. American Financing, NMLS 182334, NMLSConsumerAccess.org. Obama had a huge party to celebrate his 60th birthday at his newly acquired estate on Martha's Vineyard. And here is a short glimpse of what that party looked like. Hey, did you notice that everybody was wearing a mask? Not. This is how these people are. Now, very interestingly, there were some people who posted both photos and videos from the party. One of them was the rapper Trap Beckham and his manager TJ Chapman. They posted some Instagram photos. In fact, they even posted one of those guys smoking marijuana, which is legal in Massachusetts. But apparently what happened is the Obama people started calling all these guys and making them delete the videos. Very telling. So Trap Beckham, the rapper, deleted the videos, but he had originally said, "You got to see this, guys." Quote, "Nobody has ever seen Obama like this before." In other words, Obama with his hair down, the real Obama. His manager, Chapman, was kind of irritated to be asked to take down the videos. And he goes, "That's not cool. That's not cool." In other words, I think the guy didn't realize why the Obamas panicked and made everyone take down the videos. There's also a musician named Erica Badu who posted a video with Obama dancing, and that video was also taken down. So what's going on here is this. Obama organized this huge party. Everybody was invited. And then people started saying, "Wait a minute, what happened to social distancing? What happened to the Delta variant? What happened to the idea that we shouldn't have massive gatherings?" We're not talking about a gathering of 10 or 20 or 50 people. Other people have been prohibited from having small gatherings. Here's Obama, who, by the way, erects a huge tent for the purpose. And invites all these Hollywood celebrities, all these political celebrities. Then apparently, in order to diffuse the obvious hypocrisy of it, what they do is they say, "Well, we're going to scale back the party." And so they disinvited some people, like Larry David, the comedian, was a little annoyed. They disinvited him. But all the main people were invited, apparently. Some of the former Obama officials were a little mad because they thought, you know, we made Obama, you know, we were there with Obama. Disinvite. But Chrissy Teigen was invited. So was John Legend, Stephen Colbert. Apparently, Steven Spielberg was on the guest list, Bruce Springsteen, George Clooney. They wanted to invite Tom Hanks, but Tom Hanks was in Greece, so he didn't show up. Now, what I think is fascinating about all this is twofold. The first thing is the left-wingers, Joy Reid. Here is Annie Carney, White House correspondent for the New York Times. She goes, oh, no. This is really different. It's okay for Obama to do this. Why? Quote, because this was a sophisticated, vaccinated crowd. Yeah? Wait a minute. Are you now saying that if you are vaccinated, you can't spread the virus? I thought the Delta variant could be spread even by vaccinated people. So vaccinated doesn't do it. What about sophisticated? Wait a minute. Is this a virus that basically goes, wait a minute, those are sophisticated people. I better go in a different direction. I need to search for the Yahoos. I can't infect people like Obama and all his cool, cultured friends. Oh my gosh, this would be inappropriate. This would be a violation of social etiquette. You know, no. What we're dealing with here is hypocrisy on a titanic scale, and it's interesting to see how there are people so intellectually shameless that they'll even stand up for it. Now, Obama, of course, has been a lifelong hypocrite. We are brother's keeper. He won't help George Obama. Here's a guy, the oceans are rising. We're facing a climate catastrophe. Oh, by the way, did you get my down payment on the new estate, $12 million on Martha's Vineyard? I obviously don't believe the oceans are rising. So, I think the sensibility we extract here, and by the way, Debbie, you know, points out this is the Chavista sensibility in Venezuela to a T, is essentially we are superior people. We, the left, do not have to abide by the same standards. We're going to inflict those standards on you, but we wouldn't dream of inflicting them on ourselves. In fact, it's sort of like saying our morality is so private, we're not even going to impose it on ourselves. It's only public. It's only for your consumption. And of course, the message that we get from it, and what else can we get, is basically, you don't believe a word of it. Why should we listen to anything you say? Because your behavior, your lifestyle, your sheer contempt for these doctrines that you put out in public convinces us that you are not a person to be believed. Worried about the future because of politicians who wreck our economy? Don't worry. The real America, the innovators, are hard at work despite the Joe Bidens of the world. Now, Alex Green, the editor and chief investment strategist of the Oxford Club Investment Research Company, has been accurately predicting and guiding readers for 20 years, precisely demonstrating how to generate massive wealth for anyone willing to listen, learn, and share in the potential profits. Longtime subscriber of Alex Green, Bill O'Reilly, recently sat down with Alex to talk about the bright future of investing in America over the next 2 years. And truly, the best is yet to come. That's despite whatever nonsense is happening in the nation's capital. See for yourself. Go to messagefrombill.com. Watch this interview and sign up to the Oxford Club's free e-letter to receive a free report on how to invest in top 10 innovative stocks right now. See how to claim your copies of two best-selling books, The Gone Fishing Portfolio by Alex Green and O'Reilly's latest, Killing Crazy Horse, without paying retail or shipping. Get everything at messagefrombill.com and learn how to prosper from the real America and its innovators today. I'm really pleased to be joined by, well, an old friend of mine, a mover and shaker in Florida politics, the former head of the Florida Republican Party, now a state representative. He's running for the state Senate, Blaise Ngoglia. Blaise, great to see you again. It's been a little while. You're sporting a little bit of a different look. I think you've transferred most of the hair from the top of your head to a beard and mustache. This is a new look.
That's true.
I think you're going for the dignified look as opposed to the scrappy look which you had before. Debbie's laughing in the background.
I'm actually trying to streamline my body for the race for Senate. I'm trying to make it as efficient as possible. This is more aerodynamic.
This is awesome. Well, Blaise, you know, you've been a key figure in Florida politics, and we got a couple of things I want to talk about especially. But let me jump just right to the fact that the left is sort of ganging up right now on Florida. Because of the Delta variant, they're implying that something that's been very important to them, because Florida's been a kind of embarrassment to the left. Florida has had a relatively open state for a while. And yet, when the left predicted, oh, it's going to be, I think one guy even said genocide in Florida. There's been no genocide. Florida's actually done comparatively well. So talk a little bit about about what's happening with COVID in Florida now. Do you think DeSantis is going to sort of buckle under the pressure to impose mandates, impose lockdowns, essentially move away from the Florida model that has been such a chastisement to the left?
Well, first of all, I just want to thank you guys for the opportunity to be here. It's good to see you guys. And I'll answer the second question first. DeSantis, Ron DeSantis, will not buckle under the pressure. If there's anything we've seen out of him, he stands up. He's a leader. He knows what he believes in. He's making data-driven decisions. So, no, he's not. In fact, just the other day, a rule came out, and they said they were going to come out, and they were going to physically punish some of these school superintendents and school board members that refuse to comply with not having a mask mandate. But look, all of this is being done for one reason, and one reason only, by the corporate media, is because they're afraid of Ron DeSantis. They are afraid of conservative governing principles, because Ron DeSantis, over the last year with COVID, has proved them wrong. And conservative leadership in the Republican Party in the state of Florida has proven a lot of liberals wrong for a long time. This has nothing to do with the fact that DeSantis is leading. He's doing a good job, and he's a potential 2024 presidential candidate. That's what this all boils down to.
I mean, observing DeSantis, I got to say that here's a guy who seems to have that Trumpian resolve. But at the same time, he seems to be very calm in the way that he deals with the media. He doesn't get flustered when they attack him, and he doesn't respond with insults, but he responds with the kind of incriminating, oh, so have you read the report you're referring to? So he gets them on the substance. And I have to say, I think he's shown that conservatives can be fearless in dealing with the media, but they can do it in a way that focuses on substance, not necessarily on personality.
That's right. He argues with facts. He remains very calm. He just states his point, the reason that he's making these points, and the media just goes absolutely apoplectic when they push back. And look, we and nationally, and you've seen this, we've seen way too many Republicans for way too long just cave to the narrative of the left because they don't want to expend the time and the energy arguing with them, where this governor and a lot of good Republicans in the state of Florida push back on the media. We have outlets to push back on the media. We do it on social media. We do it in press conferences. And I think that's what many people find refreshing, is that we're just not going to take getting beaten by the liberal media in public. We're going to push back. We're going to show them that there is another side to their argument, and people need to hear the other side and let them make their own decisions, what's best for them and their family. And so far, they're choosing the conservative governance side.
You know, Blaise, I have to say, you mentioned that the reason that conservatives sometimes don't push back is, you said, that they don't want to waste their time with the media. I think they're a little afraid of the media for the most part. And one of the important things, and I think this was actually one of the great things about Trump, is he made people a little less afraid of the media. He showed that there is a way to push back. And while the Trump pushback and the DeSantis pushback may be stylistically different, I think what unites them is this idea that we don't have to cower in fear. In other words, we need a new conservatism that recognizes that these guys are not on our side. They're propagandists. They're not really journalists. When they ask a question, they're not genuinely looking for the answer. And so they've got to be treated as an adversary that you respond to with political and intellectual pressure, not by retreating. You agree?
No, I totally agree. And look, I know for a fact, because I've had conversations with some of these Republicans, what they are afraid of is an op-ed in Sunday's paper by the liberal media that they are afraid that they're going to get hammered by. Where people like me, if somebody writes an op-ed about me attacking my policies, attacking my ideas, I push back, and then I take the front page of that paper and I put it on my wall. I let everybody know that I'm going to govern in the same way Ron DeSantis governs We are going to govern by what we think is right. I don't care what the liberal media says. Ron DeSantis doesn't care what the liberal media says. And we as Republicans really shouldn't care what they say, because they are wrong most of the time and we are right most of the time. And more people believe in what we believe in than what the liberal media believes in.
When we come back, I want to ask Blaise and Gogley about two laws that he had a key role in drafting, the voter integrity law in Florida and also a law to rein in tech censorship. If you're thinking of replacing your carpets due to pet stains and odors, you gotta try Genesis 950. The reviews are fantastic. This is one product that works beautifully. Now, with water, it breaks down the bonds of stains and odors so they are gone for good. Its antibacterial component removes pet odors from carpet and padding. It can be used in a carpet cleaning machine, and it's green, so it's safe for your family and pets. Genesis 950 is made in America. 1 gallon of industrial strength Genesis 950 makes up to 7 gallons of cleaner. But Genesis 950 is also great for bathrooms, floors, upholstery, and grease stains. Debbie uses it to clean the entire kitchen. When some time ago I got chocolate on my pants, I'm a bit of a chocoholic, and on the couch, Genesis 950 took it right off. Genesis 950 has great customer service. Order 1 gallon direct at genesis950.com. You'll get a free spray bottle, free shipping, and a $10 coupon using the code Dinesh. That's genesis950.com. Coupon only available for 1 gallon purchase. Genesis 950. It's much cheaper than replacing your carpets or your pants or your couch. I'm back with Florida State Rep Blaise Ngoglia. He's running for the state Senate. Blaise, I want to talk about two important pieces of legislation, one of which you drafted, the other of which you had an active role in drafting. But the first one I want to focus on is the voter integrity law. Now, we're seeing, an effort to characterize these voter integrity laws as kind of Jim Crow 2.0. These are laws intended to, quote, suppress the vote, let every vote count. Let's talk a little bit about why these laws are so important. The left's view is, this was a very secure election the last time around. You haven't proven any systematic fraud. So why are you in such a hurry to change all these laws, if not to suppress the minority vote? To which you reply what?
That we want to make it as easy as possible to vote and as hard as possible to cheat. And that's what we did with this piece of legislation. You know, the media and a lot of these corporations are just way off base, because a lot of times I don't think they actually read what's in the bill. One of the things that we try to do here is we take, and look, anybody who says that there wasn't problems with the last election in Florida, they're just not paying attention. There were problems. There were things that we have to tighten up. Just because it wasn't big mass problems like we've seen in Pennsylvania or Georgia doesn't mean that we haven't had any issues. So we tightened up a lot of those. But a lot of the things that we did is we understand that a lot of these races are now nationalized. You have these big attorneys for the Democrats coming in and filing lawsuits in any of these states. So when we see something in Pennsylvania that we don't like, or in Georgia or in Arizona that we don't like, we're not going to wait for something to go wrong here in the state of Florida. We are going to crack down now and make sure that the problems that we saw in those states, we don't see in Florida. So the narrative is that it's racist. We're trying to keep people from the vote in the state, keep people from voting. In the state of Florida, we have up to 45 days of voting in the state of Florida. Anybody who says that that is suppressing votes is just blatantly lying.
Well, it's also obvious, isn't it, Blaise, that when, Debbie and I was making this point a couple of days ago, she was saying, look, if the Democrats were genuinely convinced that voter ID is a form of racism, then they would say that when you check into a hotel, you shouldn't have to show your ID. When you show up at the airlines, you shouldn't have to show your ID. Because after all, that is, you're suppressing minorities from traveling by plane, suppressing minorities from using, the Hilton Hotel. But since they don't say any of that, the fact that they single out voter ID in this one particular context is so revealing. They want basically be able to vote without identification, which of course allows a lot of illicit votes to go through. So isn't that what this is really about? You're trying to make it, as you say, harder to cheat, and the Democrats are trying to make it easier to cheat.
That's right. And that's all we're trying to do. We're in this, in the Florida law, we did away with ballot harvesting, which other states were trying to do. We wanted to make sure you had two-factor authorization, including voter ID, identification when you register to vote and when you request a vote by mail ballot. We got rid of Zuckerbucks coming in and pouring a bunch of money in the state of Florida. Look, all we're trying to do is make sure that everyone, regardless of race, color, gender identity, if you want, has the same access to the ballot box. And that's exactly what we did.
Let's turn to the issue of tech censorship, because it's a tricky one. On the one hand, obviously, citizens have a right to free speech. But in the First Amendment, that right is protected against the government, right? Congress shall make no law restricting freedom of speech. What's happening, it seems, is that the Democrats are using these private companies, which are quasi-monopolies, and achieving censorship through them that they couldn't directly impose through the government. And the question becomes, how does law deal with this? I mean, we're both aware that while it would be a good idea in theory to repeal Section 230, as a practical matter, that's not going to happen. So talk a little bit about what steps Florida has taken and how a Florida law that imposes penalties on a private entity like Twitter or like Facebook, how does that hold up under legal scrutiny?
Well, what we tried to do is we tried to thread the needle, because it's the Supremacy Clause, you know, federalism, obviously the federal law will override the state law. But so what we tried to do is we tried to make sure that anything that we were writing would be Florida specific, because it's Floridians that are being hurt. We tried to write the law where it wasn't violating Section 230. Now, this is being challenged in the courts right now, and I expect this to go up to the District Court of Appeals and maybe even the Supreme Court. But basically what we did was this, is that, look, we understand you're a private company, but if you are going to actively engage in shadow banning, deplatforming, and censoring, publish the guidelines that you are governing yourself by that will enable you, or you're going to fall back on if you do deplatform or censor somebody. Publish it, but then apply it equally to everyone so everyone understands it. But then when you deplatform or you censor somebody, give them 7 days heads up notice and tell them exactly why that they're being deplatformed or censored. Because when you just get the notice from these social media companies now, you have no idea what they're doing. And if you're going to do it to a candidate, you're going to face $250,000 a day fines if you're a statewide candidate, and $225,000 a day fine if you're anything other than a statewide candidate. It's the only way that we think we can hold big tech accountable here under Florida law.
Is it possible, Blaze, to go even further? I mean, you have penalties that apply essentially to government officials or people running for office. Is there a way to say, hey, listen, there's going to be a $10,000 fine if you ban without cause any citizen of Florida? In other words, is there a way to stand up for the rights of the ordinary citizen who's not even running for office, but nevertheless still has a right to participate in the political process and to be heard?
We have that in this bill. We have a cause of action where any Floridian can file a lawsuit against these big tech companies for censoring them, deplatforming, or shadow banning them. There is a vehicle for them to do it. There's a vehicle for the Attorney General to do it. So we tried to make this as broad as encompassing as possible without violating Section 230 of the federal code.
Blaze Ngogle, it's a real pleasure. Thank you for joining me. All the best with your race coming up, and congrats on all the great work you're doing in Florida.
My pleasure, my friend. Good seeing you guys. God bless.
On July 4th, 1776, we declared our independence from taxation from a government an ocean away. Today, our government is the one imposing oppressive taxes while at the same time sending our wealth overseas and driving the value of the dollar into the ground through reckless spending. Now, this is the time to declare your independence for your savings, cut your ties to the U.S. dollar, and invest in gold and silver with Birch Gold Group. Now, if you haven't reached out to Birch Gold to diversify part of your IRA or 401k into a precious metals IRA, do it today. Text Dinesh to 484848. You'll get a free information kit on protecting your savings with gold. I buy my gold from Birch Gold. They have an A-plus rating with the Better Business Bureau, countless five-star reviews, and over 10,000 happy customers. Talk to them. Have them help you safeguard your investments. Text Dinesh to 484848 to claim your free information kit and to speak with a precious metals expert on holding gold and silver in a tax-sheltered account. Again, text Dinesh to 484848 and protect your savings today. There's a very interesting skirmish that has broken out within the intellectual precincts or quarters of the right. And the argument has to do with what is the core principle? If you had to say one word that defines modern American conservatism, what would it be? Would it be virtue? Would it be freedom? Would it be prudence? Would it be equality? So you have all these terms that are used in the political lexicon, but which one takes priority? Which is the most important thing? This is an argument between two groups, the so-called paleocons. So that word means paleoconservative, old line conservative. And the old line conservatives are really all about the idea of virtue, not just personal virtue, but civic virtue. And they believe that freedom is subordinate to virtue. Freedom is important, but why is freedom important? So that you can do the right thing, so that you can live the right virtuous type of life, so society can make citizens into better people. And for the paleoconservatives, equality is not only subordinate to liberty, but equality is a very ambiguous virtue. Or equality is something that we can give only qualified enthusiasm to. Now, why is that? Because from the paleoconservative point of view, equality is only valid in very limited application. Yes, equality of rights under the law. We obviously want to have a single standard of law that applies to everybody. But let's not push that any further, because if you do, pretty soon you're down the leftist road of equality of outcomes. Pretty soon you're declaring things like all people around the world are equal, and since democracy is the best form of government, since it represents equality, the United States needs to march all over the world and make everyone into Democrats and convert all the dictators and political systems around the world into democracies. So from the paleoconservative point of view, this kind of religion of equality is a very dangerous thing. Now, let's turn to the group that they are quarreling with. The paleoconservatives are quarreling with a group that is called the Straussians. The Straussians, named after a German emigre philosopher named Leo Strauss, who came around the Nazi period from Germany, fled to the United States, taught at a bunch of universities before settling down at the University of Chicago. The followers and admirers of Strauss are called Straussians. I count myself in this group because I have learned a great deal, not only from Strauss, but from one of Strauss's most prominent students, a political scientist died recently named Harry Jaffa. Jaffa is the author of two monumental works, one of them called Crisis of the House Divided, a study of the Lincoln-Douglas debates. The other, kind of the work that closed out his life, he published a few years before his death, called A New Birth of Freedom, a study of the Gettysburg Address and Abraham Lincoln. Now, I want to focus in on Jaffa a little bit because Jaffa supports and affirms the idea of equality. Not equality in its generic sense, but the sense in which equality is used and is invoked in the Declaration of Independence. You could almost see Jaffa's work, not Strauss's, because Strauss did work on Plato, he did work on Aristotle and Al-Farabi and Maimonides, all these different philosophers. But Harry Jaffa focused in on, you could almost say, the single sentence, all men are created equal. Or in its extended form, it is a self-evident truth that all men are created equal. And all those words are critically important to Jaffa. The fact that created equal. So we're not just equal, but we're made equal by the Creator. And this is important because the Bible says that we're equal in God's eyes. And so Jaffa is implying, and I think the Declaration is suggesting, that political equality arises out of theological equality. It is because we are equal in God's eyes that no man is inherently superior to another. Now, people, of course, can be better than other people in all kinds of ways. They can be better looking, they can run faster, they can be smarter, they could be more moral in their conduct than others. But in the fundamental sense of being human and having a kind of basic human dignity, I think Jaffa's point and the Declaration of Independence suggests that this dignity, this equal dignity, comes really from a divine source. And what makes it self-evident is that you don't even have to be a theologian to see that when you look around, the problems of human nature, both the strengths and the infirmities, the weaknesses of human nature, are shared by all human beings. So we're equal in that. We're equal in being human. And Jaffa's point is that there are political consequences that come from that. And even political freedom, a representative democracy, arises out of human equality. Why? Because it is because we're equal, because all men are created equal, therefore no man has a right to rule another man without his consent. Think about it. If people were inherently unequal, if aristocrats and kings were inherently superior, then they would say, well, why do I need your consent? I'm a superior human being. I have a right to rule over you for the same reason that the lion has the right to rule over the jungle, has the right to rule over the antelope, and eat the antelope at will. So what you have here is a dispute, and I'm hardly going to resolve it here, but I'm merely kind of stating it so we can see the issue, between the paleoconservatives who are very skeptical of the idea of equality. They fear that equality is a runaway train that will lead down the progressive road. And the Straussian conservatives, the Jaffaite conservatives, who believe that equality and liberty are two sides of the same coin. We are equal, and we are free. And those things don't contradict each other. Jaffa's not defending equality of outcomes. He's defending equality of rights under the law. He's defending equal treatment under the law, but he's also defending equality in a somewhat more profound sense, that we don't have the right to lord it over each other, that we've got to recognize that whatever our human differences, there is a kind of core of commonality. We all share a bent, you may say, fallen human nature, and that should introduce a modesty in ordinary life and also a humility in political life. Of course, you've used towels all your life, but have you tried the My Pillow towels? These are not like ordinary towels. They are soft to the touch, but they don't have that kind of lotiony feel. They are based on proprietary technology, which makes them highly absorbent. Other towels can feel good, but they don't absorb. Now, the My Pillow towels are available in multiple styles and sizes. They're machine washable and durable. 10-year warranty, 60-day money-back guarantee. For a limited time, Mike Lindell is offering really a ridiculously good deal on the towel sets, a 6-piece towel set in whatever color you choose for $39.99. Normally, $109.99. Call 800-876-0227 or go to MyPillow.com. Make sure to get the discount to use the promo code Dinesh. I've been talking for the last, couple of days about Greek tragedy, and specifically about the great trilogy written by one of the three great Greek tragedians. This is Aeschylus and his great work, the Oresteia. I've spoken about the first play, Agamemnon, which describes the murder of Agamemnon by his wife, Clytemnestra, and the man that she took up with, Aegisthus. And now I want to turn to the second play in the trilogy. It's called Libation Bearers. And it continues this deeply moving and tragic family saga. It's called the Saga of the House of Atreus, because Agamemnon is descended from Atreus. But in the second play, Libation Bearers, we discover kind of a continuation of this pattern of family murder that was in the first play. Orestes, who is the son of Agamemnon and Clytemnestra, returns to take revenge on his mother, Clytemnestra, and on Aegisthus, kills them both. So notice the startling parallel. In the first play, a wife kills her husband. In the second play, the son, Orestes, returns to murder, to kill, to take revenge upon his own mom. Now, just as Agamemnon was in an impossible situation, faced with an impossible choice, Agamemnon had been ordered by Zeus to go to Troy. He had to sacrifice his daughter Iphigenia in order to get a calm wind to go to Troy. If he didn't sacrifice his daughter, he would be disobeying the god Zeus. If he did sacrifice his daughter, he would be killing his own offspring, his own child. And Orestes finds himself in exactly the same situation. And what I mean by this is that he has an absolute duty to avenge his father. His father has been murdered. He has to make someone pay for this murder. But who's responsible for the murder? His mother. And so in order to avenge his father, which he must do, he is forced to undertake a course of action absolutely forbidden to him on another grounds. What child ever has the moral authority to go kill their own parent, the very parent that gave them life, the very mother that brought them into the world? So this is Orestes' terrible choice. And as I said the last time, the fact that the choice is kind of forced upon him does not free him of the consequences of this choice. So at the beginning of this story, we have the libation bearers. Now, the libation bearers are the chorus. They're the chorus that is bringing libations, which is to say they're bringing milk and they're bringing wine to pour on the grave of Agamemnon. And present at the scene is Orestes' sister, Electra. And she has been living in this terrible household, and she knows what happened, and she too wants to avenge her dad, but she's a girl. She doesn't know what she can do. She's not in a position to carry out this revenge. And so she's there kind of waiting and hoping that her brother Orestes will show up. Orestes, by the way, has been sent away by his mom, Clytemnestra, and by Aegisthus so that he's, in a sense, supposedly was for his own safety, but he's dispatched far away. But Orestes turns up right at the grave, and he hides and he sees what's going on and he sees his sister there. And when the chorus leaves, he shows himself to his sister and he explains that he is there to avenge his father. And he says that he's got a plan, and his plan is really simple. He's going to pretend to be a messenger. Remember, it's been many years. He's been away. He's now disguised himself. He's disguised his appearance. He's apparently going to present himself as a messenger to Clytemnestra and Aegisthus and say that he's bringing news of the death of Orestes, his own death. He knows that they're probably not going to be too upset to hear this, because after all, if you think about it, the murderers are going to worry that the son of the victim might show up sometime to have revenge. So Orestes goes, this is how I'm going to get into the palace. And then once I get into the palace, I'm going to kill them both. Orestes has a friend with him, by the way, a guy named Pylades. And what's kind of interesting is that for the whole play, except for one time, Pylades says absolutely nothing. Now, Orestes is able to make his way into the palace. Clytemnestra actually welcomes him. She is a very cunning woman, but she doesn't see through Orestes' disguise. She goes, oh, welcome, visitor. And when Orestes tells her, I'm bringing you, you know, news of the death of Orestes, she very calmly digests the advice. She doesn't seem particularly perturbed about it. But Orestes makes his way into the palace. He finds Aegisthus and he immediately kills him. Now, Aegisthus begins to scream, and Clytemnestra hears the screaming. She goes, what's going on? And one of the servants shouts, there's death that has come to this palace. And Clytemnestra, who's extremely smart, realizes, oh my gosh, this is Orestes. She knows right away. And so she shouts out, bring me an axe. Think about it. She's absolutely ready to cut her son in two to defend herself. She's absolutely ready to do what is necessary to protect her position. But it's too late. Before an axe can be produced, there's Orestes, and with a bloody sword. And Orestes now begins to approach his mom in the climactic or great scene of this play. Now, when Orestes approaches his mom, sword drawn, his mom is extremely emotionally manipulative. What she does is she basically pulls out her breast and shows it to Orestes. And she says, this is the breast that suckled you when you were a baby. So she's appealing in the rawest sense. And for the Greeks, this symbol, this idea of a mother bearing a breast, was the ultimate in vulnerability, the ultimate of appealing to compassion in your child. And it does cause Orestes to hesitate for just a moment. Orestes sort of helplessly turns to Pylades, his friend, and basically says, what now? What should I do? And Pylades utters the only lines he utters in the whole play. He basically says, be faithful to Zeus, be faithful to the oats. And then his line, call all men hateful to you except, call all men hateful to you rather than the gods. In other words, Pilate is speaking, the only lines he speaks in the play is in effect saying, you got to do it. You got to go for it. And Orestes does. He draws his sword. He drags Clytemnestra to the next room. Now notice in Greek tragedy, you couldn't have the murder on the stage. They didn't even have the ability to show that in terms of effects. So generally this kind of thing occurred off stage, but you could hear it. A messenger would typically report it. You would see the effects of it. And so you can hear Clytemnestra as she's dragged away. She completely turns on her son and starts calling him a snake. So no longer is he the son that should take compassion. She now says, you're a snake. And Orestes goes ahead and kills his mother. Now, when he comes back, he is completely drained because he knows what he's done and he knows the implications of it. He knows Orestes, very interestingly, does not claim that what he did is right. In fact, he says to his mother, you did wrong, and now you're going to suffer wrong. And when he comes back with his sword covered in blood, Orestes basically says, what I did is, quote, not without some right, meaning I had some justification in doing what I did. At the close of this play, we hear what is called the Furies. And the Furies are the spirits of divine vengeance. They're these angry, bloody-eyed spirits, and they are coming to basically get Orestes, because essentially Orestes has committed, and it doesn't matter why he did it, the unforgivable crime of killing his own mother, and he has to pay for that. And the Furies are these divine creatures that are there to torment Orestes, to drive him insane, to destroy him. And so it's almost as if this is never going to end. The wife kills the husband, the son kills the mother, and now the Furies are after Orestes himself. Tomorrow, in my concluding discussion of this whole trilogy, I'll talk about the third play, Eumenides, which takes up this issue. What's going to happen? Is this ever going to end? And shows how this notion of individual vengeance needs to be replaced by some other system that is able to establish both divine and human justice.
Subscribe to the Dinesh D'Souza podcast on Apple, Google, and Spotify, or watch on Rumble, YouTube, and SalemNow.com.